pissed off, hair trigger, and punitive as hell. One early warning sign, like the faint radar echoes presaging a bomber attack, came early on in the Trump campaign. It was in the form of a single picture the great news photographer Mark Wallheiser took at a Trump rally in Mobile, Alabama on August 22, 2015. You know the one. Trump supporters, wild-eyed and hypnotized, reaching across a rope line to touch the Donald. Even controlling for the fact that the rally was in Mobile, that look of cult-like devotion and the intensity of the crowd should have been a clearer signal. Yes, the elite GOP's instant not-our-kind-dear reaction was part of our insularity, but that look, that sign. One woman was holding her child with an expression that said, "I offer my infant as sacrifice to you, Lord Trump. Devour him at your leisure." In many long years in politics, I've never seen that look for any Republican candidate, ever. I'd seen something close to it in the eyes of Obama's fans, most certainly. But even for candidates with passionate followings, that white-hot, I-won't-be-ignored bunny boiler cray is like a political unicorn. Marco had his fans, as did Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, and Ben Carson. Even Ted Cruz had his, oh, never mind. The Paulites were famous for a certain kind of, shall we say, overly dedicated fan, mostly of the late 20s still-a-virgin libertarian variety. This was new territory. The obsession with Trump was crazy ex-girlfriend, multiple restraining orders loony. And for a while it was fun to ignore it, to write it off as the reddest state red staters fanboying the celebrity candidate they knew so well from TV. The rallies, the stage show, the hats, the pure, unadulterated fanaticism wasn't simply about the election itself. It was about a decoupling of the Republican Party from ideas and ideals and its new attachment to the dear leader. We didn't see it coming soon enough. We should have taken it more seriously, like people who know that a bite on the hand is the first sign of the zombie apocalypse. Deal with it fast, or everyone's going to end up in a mindless, undead, cannibalistic rage. The post-thought Trump supporter made the most rabid Obama fandom look tepid in comparison. For all our mockery and indifference, we didn't see that there was a deep strain in American political life that isn't seeking party rigor or ideological purity or even an independent iconoclast, but the safe reinforcement of the pack of people just as pissed off as they are. We underestimated the deep human psychological need to be a part of a movement based not on hope, but on channeling the comments section of the nuttiest blogs. That's what Trump gave them. He was an avatar for their anger, their impotence, and their blame-storming for everything wrong in their world. For once in their shallow, sad, TV-inflected lives, they felt like they were the cool kids. That picture said it all. Trump was offering himself up not only as the avatar for their anger with the existing administration, but as something more, something protean and dangerous. As the months of 2015 dragged on, I came to realize that Obama and Trump fanatics were two sides of the same personality cult coin. The cognitive dissonance between what the Trump faction hated about Obama and what they loved about Donald was notable. And after Trump's victory, even more striking in that Obama's fans had seemed pretty happy just to elect him. They weren't, as a rule, even angrier after the election. The odd parallels in fanaticism are striking. Trump fans hated Obama's cult-like followers with their mindless stares of adoration, their impervious barrier between emotion and reason, and their instant fury when confronted with the facts about his record, his history, or his philosophy. They reviled hope as shallow and superficial, but embraced MAGA with gusto. The conservative conceit of being the party with a robust philosophical underpinning from Burke to Buckley was guilty of the same kind of shallow love of a stunt-casting celebrity candidate that they mocked in the Democrats of 2008. Conservatives at the time despised Obama's obviously empty promises to credulous, low-information voters on the left and center. They loved it from Trump, and still do. They furiously blasted Obama for soft-peddling his positions on single-payer health care, gay marriage, gun control, and abortion to get elected, and that the media let him slide on a catalog of political sins. Trump fans took this to an entirely new level. They mocked Obama's promises of millions of new jobs in the clean energy sector, but adored Trump's gauzy, anachronistic promises to bring back millions of jobs in dead industries like coal, buggy whips, and witch-finding. They hated how Obama rode into office on the wave of constant attention from the mainstream media. They loathed how the press played along with his game, draining the life out of every other candidate by describing him as an inevitable juggernaut, an unstoppable political force, and a game-changer who was tapping into something deep and powerful in American political life. Bless their deplorable little hearts, they loved it from Trump. They hated how Obama's naive ignorance of the real and brutal world of international affairs was papered over by his hollow promises to make the world respect the United States again. But Trump's Russia-inflected win, nuclear brinksmanship, and diplomacy-free MAGA with MOABs, beloved. They hated Obama's casual disdain for people who weren't from a major city where, you know, all the rich, smart, educated, liberal people like him live. But they loved it from Trump. Trump is about as heartland America as I am a lap reindeer hunter. They hated Obama's elite credentialism and how he wielded his Harvard and Columbia degrees to browbeat his aspiring class opponents from outside the meritocracy, and how he used them to cow an already docile press. But they loved it from President Best Mind, who bellowed his alleged Wharton credentials every chance he got. As much as Republicans hated when Obama slipped and had a smug expression that felt like he was mocking the stupidity of the unwashed, they loved Trump's sneering japery. Republicans hated Obama's cadre of glassy-eyed, creepy advisors with their combination of over-the-edge ideological fervor and dead-ender stares of adoration for the glorious leader. But they loved the misfit toy collection of weirdos, former golf caddies, Russian-tied sleazeball consultants, reporter-punching thug campaign managers, dissipated bullshit artists, and peppy army sleeper cell members who followed in Trump's wake. They hated Obama's support for bailouts, too big to fail, and heavy-handed, taxpayer-funded government intervention in industries. But they loved it from Trump, a man promising to keep his boot on the throat of companies that didn't cooperate with his America First agenda. They hated Obama's comfy alliance with Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and the odious Clinton family enterprise. But they shrugged at Trump's lifetime of donations to the most liberal Democrats in the country. They hated Obama's cavalier disdain for private property rights, but they loved it from Trump. "He's a businessman," was the universal cry to excuse any sin. Everything that set their teeth on edge, raised their hackles, and made them loathe Barack Obama is there in Donald Trump. Every aspect of the con game Obama played on America in 2008, the obsessive focus on one base issue, for Obama, the war in Iraq, for Trump, immigration, the cult-like obsession, the instant attacks on apostates, the willful ignorance of his history and his beliefs, is present in Trump. Everything they despised in Obama's political character and behavior, they love from Trump. Part of Trump's dark appeal struck on the common idea that only he could redress the wrongs of the past, and only he could avenge them. The future they experienced was one of international dangers on every side, domestic upheavals, cultural and social fluidity, and endless, savage economic destruction. They saw Wall Street and Washington as ravenous, heartless, and hungry for their last scraps of self-worth and net worth. The master con man saw what the Marx wanted and gave it to them. Over and over, he framed arguments about the way things used to be. In his beer hall-style rallies, Trump talked about knocking the hell out of people. His was the language of the brawler safely behind the cordon of security, but it was effective, nevertheless. Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon smoothed out the rhetorical edges on the nostalgia campaign, seamlessly merging with their vision of nationalist populism. Trump soon promised a return to coal mines, steel mills, ironworks, town criers, and the village blacksmith. While most modern presidents looked back 20 or perhaps 30 years in their retrospective visions, Trump took it all the way back to the 50s. Mostly the 1850s. It was irresistible to people raised in a climate of rapid change and fed a constant stream of "the liberals are destroying you" cable news. More than any presidential candidate in the past, Trump let them speak their hatreds aloud. It was Muslims. It was the crafty Mexican army of immigrants coming to take their jobs, pillage their suburbs, flood their streets with taco trucks, and impregnate their womenfolk. It was the Chinese, implacable and inscrutable. He left it to his alt-right allies to whisper in the darkness, "It's the Jews. It's the blacks." His base loved it. They ate it up with a spoon. If Trump had proposed repealing child labor laws to allow kids to mine coal, They would have roared their approval at sending little tykes down pit with hammers and pickaxes. Trump promised his base a world where they could all go back to the 1950s, where a high school graduate could get a job down at the local steel mill that could support a family. It was a cruel lie, and he knew it. He promised a return to American manufacturing prowess not based on innovation, disruption, or competition, but by using trade deals and immigration policy in which Washington picked winners and losers. He promised punitive measures against anyone who resisted. The unsubtle code, and let's be honest, Trump voters don't really do subtle, was that America would be safer, whiter, straighter, and more Christian. We'd be isolated from the evils of the world by walls and warriors. It was one of the most striking and dishonest sales pitches in American political history. And that includes William Howard Taft's promise to fight an MMA match with Elihu Root to settle the Ballinger-Pinchot affair. The wall is in our hearts. The wall. You know, the wall that was going to span America from the Pacific to the Gulf of Mexico. That wall that Mexico was going to pay for. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mark my words. A staple of rally after rally, call and response after call and response, the wall became a singular, powerful, and incredibly stupid signifier of the Trump con. Those of us not easily taken in by simple state fair carny tricks realized right away this was boob bait for the rubes. It had so many embedded meanings, mostly about brown people and the threat they posed to the virginal white daughters and high-paying jobs of America's heroic, beleaguered white working class. It was classic Trump pitchmanship. Promise an impossible project, get someone else to pay for it, and leave investors holding the bag when it never gets built. When the early models for Douche Hinge were unveiled in the fall of 2018, many of Trump's fervent supporters believed the job was practically done. The master builder would protect them with ramparts and towers like some medieval warlord drawing his serfs inside the castle walls as Goths or Franks or Mongols approached. Trump would pretend the wall was going to stop the bad things in brown people, when in reality he barely bestirred his round ass to do any of the political things needed to make a deal to build the wall. The Democrats offered the easiest path possible by offering to fund Donnie's pet project in exchange for a DACA fix. It's telling that for Trump, the issue was never worth any compromise with the hot nationalists around him. Of course, the wall as a signifier was always more important than the wall qua wall. It was a way of making racial animus acceptable. It was a method for Trumpites to distance themselves from actually having to see Mexican immigrants face to face, to attach a story to a statistic. The wall was magical thinking writ large, ignorant of history, economics, immigration, and the American story. A common trope of the wall crowd was, "Without borders, we don't have a nation." The alt-right and immigration hardliners loved this theme and repeated it endlessly. Trump's ideological architects, Miller, Bannon, Gorka, and Coulter, never understood that the propositional nature of America was always bigger and more powerful than their blinkered racial interpretation of this country. They weren't protecting what we are and can be. They're just second-order effects of a decline in the idea and ideals of America. Call me a cockeyed optimist about the power of this country to not only welcome, but create new Americans. But I still believe we're a system, not a race. We're a nation of universal ideals and principles, not just a few lines on a map or a wall in the desert. Muslim bans, mass deportations, and other MAGA fantasies. Trump's promises of Muslim bans and deportations were perfect fodder for the Breitbart set. In their conception of the world, every Muslim is one YouTube video away from strapping on a bomb vest or taking control of an airliner. The argument that we are in a war of civilizations with an implacable, global, and Muslim enemy has become deeply wired into the conservative worldview promulgated by Fox, Breitbart, and other Trump-friendly media. Once in office, Bannon and Miller cooked up Trump's now infamous Muslim ban, which went about as well as expected for people with no knowledge of government or the law. Breitbart and other Trump-right media outlets were in paroxysms of joy. The ban was shot down by the courts off and on for the next year, with subsequent iterations getting a long series of boot-to-the-head smackdowns. The travel ban was fatally flawed, but that didn't stop the Camelot of Stupid from pursuing it until the last dog died. There are a dozen other ways to stop Islamic terrorism, but why not just engage in trolling by executive order instead? Of course, Islamic terror is a painful and serious reality in the world. We've fought an almost 20-year global conflict since that terrible day in September 2001 and lost almost 5,000 military and 3,000 civilian lives in the process. What Trump and his allies don't want you to know is that when it comes to violence on our shores, the alt-right and white supremacists have been running neck and neck with Al-Qaeda and ISIS in this country for the past 2 years, but they'd prefer to isolate, segregate, and persecute Muslims. In an interview with Chuck Todd on Meet the Press in August of 2016, Trump promised to deport the Dreamers and their families. Todd, incredulous, asked Trump if he really meant he was going to deport the children of immigrants and their families. Trump repeated, "They have to go. They have to go." Quite obviously, they didn't. No, they didn't take your gerb. Economic illiterates get taken. Again. A central tenet of Trump's nationalist populism is the rhetorical primacy of trade wars. He successfully convinced a chunk of the electorate that their economic problems came from the horde of job-stealing Mexicans and wily Chinese. Too bad none of it was true. The trade war Donald Trump launched in 2018 may have the support of his economically illiterate base, but the consequences to the American economy promise to be devastating. Trump's dumb obsession with trade deals stretches back decades and reflects his own idiotic hubris and his own skills at the negotiating table. His promise to shred trade agreements like NAFTA and to renegotiate stupid trade deals reflects a common and utterly wrong view among his voters that international trade, the global supply chain, just-in-time delivery, and a rapidly expanding international economy and services are somehow a bad thing. Trump's long-standing, notoriously dumb hatred of NAFTA was an echo of Ross Perot's 1992 complaints about the free trade agreement. That was what worried smart trade experts the most at first, but as with all things Trump, it can always get worse. After all, no one would be stupid enough to provoke a trade war with China and Asia, right? As Trump slowly purged every common-sense mainstream economist from his circle, he left the White House Goldman guys, Republican free traders, and prior to Trump, the vast majority, and Wall Street suffering from their own case of everything Trump touches dies. That left Peter Navarro, Larry Kudlow, and Wilbur Ross still at the table, and those men share the Trump-Bannon view of trade, namely, that it's a sucker game and that America has been undercut both by the guile of devious foreigners and by the perfidy of American trade negotiators who lack the Trumpian edge for the art of the deal. It's not simply that Trump doesn't get it. This isn't a policy debate with two sides. Conservatives fought for free trade because markets matter. Conservatives fought against tariffs because tariffs are taxes. Trade is good. Tariffs in isolation are bad. All nations seek advantage, and our global trade system is far from perfect, but the alternatives are spectacularly, existentially bad. A drunk monkey can understand this, which is why it's an impenetrable mystery to this president. There's a monstrous, looming Mount Everest of economic studies and real-world examples that the Trump trade war and tariffs path leads to economic disaster. The irony was lost on the MAGA crowd, of course, because they're the ones who will bear the costs and the burden of his blistering stupidity. That cruel nostalgia about closed borders and high tariffs making the nation secure, militarily and economically, was a snare and a delusion. It was Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro circle-jerking themselves into an alternate economic universe where Americans could stand on an assembly line soldering chips to PCBs for $2 an hour. The so-called trade deficit in material goods ignored the fundamental reality of the new American economy. We do things, not just build things. I know the tangible end product of a widget assembly line may seem more real, but American services, intellectual property, and ideas matter just as much now as do cars, pork bellies, and frozen concentrated orange juice. Americans, more than most, benefit from the global web of trade and goods and services. A global regime of free trade has made us richer, more influential, and more secure. It has opened up markets for U.S. products and services around the world. As in any global system of multivariate inputs, the upsides can be unevenly distributed. But closing down a multi-decade system of trade freedoms would inevitably lead to less, not more, prosperity. What Trump didn't, wouldn't, or couldn't understand was that sometimes the vast global consensus of experts is right. He just had to touch the hot stove. Since the defenders of Trump's trade policy were thin on the ground, his supporters often fell back on Ronald Reagan as a policy backstop. They were, of course, embarrassingly wrong about the impact of trade policy under Reagan. Colin Grabow and Scott Linsingham of the Cato Institute wrote, "The WTO, ironically a Reagan-era accomplishment today decried by President Trump, provides a new and impressive venue for resolving trade disputes without, in almost all cases, the need for unilateral action. The United States has prevailed in 86% of the complaints that it has brought to the WTO, all without angering our trading partners, disrupting markets, or burdening American consumers." Trumpist intellectuals' frequent invocations of Reagan to defend President Trump's protectionism ignore ample historical context, actual policy results, and the evolution of the modern global trading system. Seen in the proper light, Reagan's legacy argues strongly in favor of free trade and multilateral engagement, rather than a return to a bygone era of trade policy failure. Trump's unfortunate press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, made a statement at the launch of Trump's trade war that is sure to go down in the famous Dumb Last Words Hall of Fame. Quote, "We may have a little bit of short-term pain, but we're going to have long-term success," she said just before the stock market cooked off over 1,000 points in a week. But the game wasn't played on a one-way street. The Chinese got a vote in the battle, and vote they did. Within days, and with a precision that made me laugh, they launched their own new round of tariffs on things like corn, hogs, and soybeans. Trump apparently couldn't see into the future far enough to know that China would immediately put tariffs on bourbon from Mitch McConnell's home state of Kentucky and on the Harley-Davidson motorcycles made in Paul Ryan's backyard. All of China's decisions targeted districts and states squarely in the heart of Trump country. If Iowans didn't know about the everything Trump touches dies curse before the trade war, they certainly got the picture rather quickly after its opening skirmishes. Trump, indulging his economic ignorance, never considered that in a boxing match on trade, that China could push back with sanctions that hurt folks who voted for him. Like all techno-peasants and economic boobs, Trump didn't understand the global economy, or the imperfect but resilient web of commerce that has made the U.S. and China the ultimate economic frenemies. Yes, Americans no longer build certain things our Chinese slave factories deliver. On the other hand, we enjoy cheap consumer goods, an astounding quality of life, and an economy that is as much about ideas as it is about heavy manufacturing. He failed to understand that the Chinese could crash the entire U.S. economy if they just sat out one T-bill auction. The idea that Trump is a brilliant international business leader is deeply embedded in the minds of people who watch too much reality television. There's just one problem. He's not. In the first major trade skirmish of the 21st century, he proved it over and over. The modern paranoid style. Trump's base is the logical endpoint of both the anti-intellectualism and the off-sided paranoid style of American politics predicted by the great historian and observer of American political life, Richard Hofstadter, in 1964. Their contempt for experience, knowledge, and qualifications was perfectly captured in Tom Nichols' The Death of Expertise, just as the Trump movement began its descent into outright rejection of traditional Republican and conservative principles. After the election, almost unbelievably, that paranoia became even more pronounced. The Republican Party's headfirst dive into breathless conspiratorial fantasies in defense of President Trump was a brand-defining moment for the party of Lincoln. The GOP spent 2017 and 2018 morphing into the party of LaRouche. Listening, as members of Congress, the Fox News and talk radio world, and the constellation of batshit crazy people drawn to esoteric Trumpism adopted increasingly Baroque theories to protect the Donald wasn't just depressing, it was tragic. The tools that radically democratized communication and broke the monopoly of a few corporate media titans on shaping the national media agenda formed a sluice into the Facebook feeds of millions of voters. These voters aren't looking for news or information. They're looking for confirmation of their beliefs and their biases and for ways to justify their rage. The diseased slurry of fake news, post-truth Trumpism, and Ruski agitprop available at the click of a mouse is ludicrous, comically overdrawn, patently false, and depressingly common. It wasn't just the postmodern propaganda stylings of Russia's information warfare specialists. A cottage industry of fake news sites of varying longevity appeared in a Darwinian struggle to get lower-class Americans to click share on their latest story of Hillary and Huma's recipe for roast baby. This Ebola of wild-eyed MK-Ultra paranoiac raving quickly spread to every organ of the Republican body politic through disease vectors no one could have foreseen. Suddenly, Reddit wasn't just for nerdy dudes talking gaming, tech, and Bitcoin. Suddenly, it was Midwestern Trump fanatic housewives following Reddit's R the Donald and, God forbid, 4chan. Conspiracy theories from Pizzagate to Uranium One, from Seth Rich to QAnon, they're all connected, man. Just wait until I tell you about the Jews and global banking, became more involved, more complex, and more contingent on a continued suspension of disbelief. In the spring of 2018, a Trump fan sent me a long email connecting a project I had done in German politics in 2005 to the fact that Angela Merkel was Hitler's daughter, produced by a secret artificial insemination program, and claiming I was part of the Rothschild, Catholic Church, Communist Soros conspiracy that Trump was working his heart out to stop. This person wasn't an ordinary troll, just a Trump lover who had slipped into the warm bath of conspiracy cray. The depth of this dive into paranoia, propaganda, and alternate truth illustrates just how deeply Trump has touched the psyche of his followers. Part of it is understandable human psychology. There must be something causing the cognitive dissonance between what they see and what they want, and the more crazy pants the theory, the more comfort they find in it. Trump himself is one of the most aggressive peddlers of conspiracy theories, which should surprise no one at this point. The conspiracies he pushes to his audience of 50 million social media followers range from the infamous to the inane. But no president before ever had a personal media channel into the minds of millions of Americans. Why does this matter? First, there's an abundantly clear chain of evidence stretching back more than a decade before he ran for office that Trump was inclined to believe the world is governed by dark forces that simply don't exist. The world is dark and crappy enough without making up new conspiracy theories to add to the chaos. Roger Stone, a longtime Trump insider and confidant, has both monetized and weaponized conspiracy nonsense for a generation. Second, it matters because his followers aren't, to be generous, all that brilliant about parsing fantasy from reality, confirmation bias from data, and truth from the most dramatic fictional perspectives. Alternate facts aren't facts. The leap from, I want to believe Hillary Clinton is bad on the issues, to, Hillary murdered Seth Rich with her bare hands before changing out of her bloodied pantsuit to head to a cannibal pizza party, is a short one for these folks, particularly when they have characters like Sean Hannity, the Lord Haw-Haw Fox stoking the lunatic flames. Third, it matters because he's now the President of the United States of America. A president makes decisions based, one hopes, on facts, and from those facts makes policies based on principles. Much of what Donald Trump believes is based on facts only in the most tangential way, and the election of 2016 didn't punish him for this. His continued visitations to the catalog of greatest conspiracy hits to rouse his base to anger and action are as corrosive as they are dangerous. Let's review a few of the InfoWars president's most treasured kookspiracy favorites, shall we? The ludicrous theory that Barack Obama was a Kenyan sleeper agent and that his birth certificate was fake sits atop a golden pyramid of dumbassery. It was always absurd, easily debunked, and politically idiotic. So, of course, Trump, inspired by Roger Stone, you'll be shocked to hear, embraced it with gusto. If there was a single, long lead warning that my party would eventually lose its goddamned mind and sink into the messy world of alternate facts, this was it. Trump's promotion of birtherism spanned Twitter, Fox News, and a host of television interviews. In March 2008, he appeared on The View with Whoopi Goldberg and Barbara Walters, milking the birther game for all it was worth. I want him to show his birth certificate. There's something on that birth certificate he doesn't like, said Trump. A few days later, he told Fox and Friends, he's spent millions of dollars trying to get away from this issue. Millions of dollars in legal fees trying to get away from this issue. And I'll tell you what, I brought it up just routinely, and all of a sudden a lot of facts are emerging, and I'm starting to wonder myself whether or not he was born in this country. As you'd expect, Trump's birtherism was a gumbo of racism and easily disproved conspiracy lunacy. It continued well after Obama released a copy of his birth certificate in June 2008. Trump tweeted, when I was 18, people called me Donald Trump. When he was 18, Barack Obama was Barry Soweto. Weird. And I want to see Barack Obama's college records to see how he listed his place of birth in the application. The capstone of the crazy and the peak moment of Trump's birtherism came when Loretta Fuddy, the head of Hawaii's Department of Health, was killed in a small plane crash. Fuddy had verified for the world that Barack Obama's birth certificate wasn't the product of some decades-old plot to hide his birth in Kenya, but a perfectly routine matter. Of course, Trump put the most lurid spin on her death, tweeting, how amazing! The state health director who verified copies of Obama's birth certificate died in a plane crash today. All others lived. As a side note, I was among the first, if not the first, GOP consultants to call out the birther bullshit. It took my opposition researcher 3 phone calls in 2008 to confirm the existence of the birth certificate and the newspaper article announcing his birth. It was always a dumb conspiracy, and Trump was always its most aggressive and mulishly stubborn advocate. 3 million zombies. Once upon a time, our firm was hired by an advocacy group called True the Vote. It was a rising force in the conservative landscape during the late Obama era, including playing a starring role in the Obama-era IRS targeting of conservative groups. When my associate Ryan Wiggins and I came on board, we treated it like any other political public relations client and went to work learning the ropes of their advocacy needs and their operation. The sole predicate of True the Vote was that millions upon millions of illegal votes are cast in every election and that voter fraud is a rampant problem across the nation, which gives Democrats, the architects of this broad and systemic problem, an unspeakable electoral advantage. Just like lawyers fighting for their clients, Ryan and I were ready to swing for the fences for ours. I'm sure if you dug through my Twitter archive and press statements, you'd find us doing just that. At least at first. You see, there was just one problem. As the leading voter fraud prevention group in the country, True the Vote couldn't provide enough data to make a convincing case even for us, far less to paint a picture of a massive conspiracy to push illegal voters to the polls. Sure, they had some individual pissant cases they could point to, but nothing broader than some one-off local yokel stories. Voter fraud, like voter suppression, does exist, but not at scale. It's a onesie-twosie precinct-level problem, not a dark and sinister Soros-Hillary gray alien plot to subvert democracy. I tell you the story of my True the Vote experience because, of course, Donald Trump believes that his popular vote loss against crooked Hillary couldn't be because he's a morally loathsome jackhole. It must have been some kind of conspiracy against him to steal the votes he bigly deserved. Thus began the oft-repeated Trumpian lie of 3 million illegal voters. Before the election, Trump and his allies claimed that millions of illegal aliens, dead people, criminals, and other undesirables would be out in force, all marshaled by Hillary's chthonic allies. Before the 2016 election, when the numbers, common sense, and political landscape all indicated a Clinton victory, Trump's drama queen tweets looked like a combination of pre-loss martyrdom and raving paranoia. He tweeted, "The election is absolutely being rigged by the dishonest and distorted media pushing crooked Hillary, but also at many polling places. Sad." And, "Of course there's large-scale voter fraud happening on and before Election Day. Why do Republican leaders deny what is going on? So naive." Even after his victory, Trump continued to sell his followers the myth that 3 million Americans who voted for Clinton were the political undead. Amazingly, his followers continued to buy the conspiracy wholesale, even as the Voter Fraud Commission Trump established fell under its own weight. Ted's dad. I touched on this a bit earlier when I profiled how Ted Cruz was one of Donald Trump's most important enablers. The dumbest smart guy in the race, Cruz not only let Trump call his wife ugly, but could barely muster a coherent response to an attack never before seen in American politics. A presidential candidate accusing another presidential candidate's father of having played a role in the assassination of another president. In our dogs and fleas department, you won't be surprised the origin of this particular theory came from the fevered mind of Roger Stone, who had, by the merest coincidence, I'm sure, a book out around that time about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The influence of Roger Stone, Roy Cohn's mini-me, on Trump over the decades is one explanation for Trump's embrace of conspiracy. Rather than politics, Stone's product in the past two decades has been a string of books about the Bush crime family and how JFK was killed by LBJ and how the Clintons have left a string of dead bodies in their wake. Trump's natural instinct for propaganda is coupled with his love of conspiracy. Dark forces acting to stop him from fulfilling the promise of MAGA, be they in the FBI, the media, or the Bavarian Illuminati. Roger went from appearing on cable networks rather frequently as a showy but entertaining political hack to appearing on InfoWars wearing a black beret and engaging in spittle-flecked old man rants about getting the deep state off his lawn. Conspiracy politics are engaging. They're a way to get to a unified truth for people uncomfortable with the chaos and messiness in the real world. They offer some hint of an esoteric truth to explain the mundane, and to enlighten those without the discipline to learn more about the mechanical details of politics, economics, and society. The rise of highly discreet, self-reinforcing and selecting social media platforms and channels makes it easier than ever to have ideas that are patently absurd become the defining truths and public character of political parties and movements. As a rule, conspiracies are hard to sustain. The old adage that three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead is consistently true. And in politics, where the currency is information and gossip, one might even be too many. Conspiracies are even harder to manage when you're stupid, as the Trump team proves every day. Since projection is the sincerest form of flattery in Trumplandia, the idea that the insidious Never Trump movement is constantly stirring hatred of the president is a constant. I wish. Believe me, I'd love it if the secret Never Trump meetings looked like the get-together and Eyes Wide Shut. Who doesn't love a good cloak-and-mask orgy in a New York mansion while you're manipulating the secret levers of power? As I said at the beginning of this chapter, I know I'm not supposed to make fun of Trump's base voters. But between their cultish worship of Trump, their abandonment of conservative principles, and their headlong embrace of batshit conspiracies, they make it all too easy. Inside the Oval Office. Act 4. One by one, they're all gone. Spicer, Bannon, Gorka, the Mooch. Sure, Jared and Ivanka are still around, but most days they keep to themselves. You'd liked Tillerson and Price and Dearborn, and it had been cool meeting a real-life celebrity like Omarosa. The place just kept slowly emptying out. You'd been able to move up to a slightly larger closet. The president, perhaps twice or even four times a week, would call or summon you to the Oval. Once you heard Hope Hicks hiss into her phone, "He's talking to his pet again." Soon, she was gone too. You tried to give the president good advice when he asked for it, but most of the time, he didn't ask. He just talked and talked and talked. It was in the spring of 2018 when you noticed something you'd tried to avoid for a long time. Donald Trump wasn't just a little off kilter. He wasn't just different. As much as you loved him and your job at the White House, it was frightening to see him up close, unfocused, agitated, and as much as you hated to admit it, delusional. You didn't have the heart to tell him that the wall wasn't already over 3,000 miles long, or that Robert Mueller had never been a high priest in a satanic child cannibalism ring based in a Target store in Alexandria, Virginia. Maybe the GDP wasn't up 41% as the president claimed. Was it Mueller? Russia? Maybe. Was it Stormy Daniels? Almost certainly. He talked about her bangability with you time and again, counseling you to follow the old grab-em strategy he'd perfected over the decades. You didn't have time to get your dry cleaning, much less a date. Finally, the grim day arrived. John Kelly resigned. Jim Mattis took a walk. Almost none of the original cabinet remained. Zinke's perp walk had shocked no one except POTUS. The corruption cases mounted, the domestic policy achievements fell flat, and 2019 looked bleak as hell. The House fell in the fall of 2018's electoral sweep by Democrats. The Senate was a tie. The idea of getting the president out on the stump for his re-election campaign kept being deferred, ostensibly because the president was so busy, but in reality, because he was so broken and crazy. The Mueller investigation ground on and on, with a broken White House now largely abandoned. The elections in the fall of 2018 made it clear there wouldn't be much more MAGA agenda. Melania had been out on a permanent B-Best tour and had been romantically linked to the head of her security detail. The president hardly seemed to care or even remember her. All he could talk about was Mueller. Then abruptly, the president looked up and said, "Fartknocker, I don't think you're cut out for this job. I asked you to save America, and all you've done is betray me." You don't know where it came from. You thought everything was fine. You'd done your best to clean up the messes the old members of the cabinet and the executive branch appointees had left behind. You realized something right then. He's loyal to nothing and to no one. Chapter 8. Limited Government. As a younger conservative, I tried many times to unwind some college liberal for conflating conservatism with fascism. Conservatives aren't fascists, I'd say in slow, non-threatening tones as I reached for a rock. Fascists believe in government control of the state and of the economy. We believe in limiting the power of government and in free markets, individual liberty, and the rule of law. On the other side of the equation, our libertarian friends used to basically pretend we could burn the entire enterprise of government to the ground and let a jolly wave of pure, cleansing anarcho-capitalist fire set things right. Of course, neither extreme was correct about mainstream, limited government conservatism. But we were largely in the sweet spot. We didn't want the government getting much bigger, but we didn't want grannies wrestling rats in the street for scraps of food either. Looking back on Republican presidents since Nixon, we see one hallmark of their campaign rhetoric and in their governance: a caution over the size, scope, cost, and power of government. None of them was perfect at restraining its growth. The Department of Homeland Security and George W. Bush's Medicare expansion stand as two particularly painful examples. But fans of an expanded state would be hard-pressed to see Reagan, George H.W. Bush, or George W. Bush embracing massive expansions in federal power without compelling reasons. After a beatdown in the 1994 elections, even Bill Clinton famously said, "The era of big government is over." The defining ethos of limited government conservatism still recognized the legitimate role of government and the powers of the state. The broad conservative consensus was that while the government is generally inefficient, slow, clumsy, dumb, overly intrusive, chock-full of layabouts, and has god-awful design sensibilities, there are areas for which the family, churches, social institutions, the market, and local government simply can't scale. No one expects Topeka, Kansas to field a nuclear deterrent or Rhode Island to administer its own postal system. So much for that argument in the era of Trump. Generations of Republican candidates for House, Senate, governor, and local offices argued that the government's size, power, and impact on everyday Americans was a pernicious danger to the republic. Donald Trump erased that from the Republican vocabulary in a matter of months. Those in office who still believe government can be too big keep silent when President Statist pushes for a bigger, more intrusive state. The GOP is now the party of big government, and it's all Trump's fault. Like so many would-be and actual autocrats, Trump believes in an expanded state and putting the power of an expanded federal government to work for his political ends. He's also been surrounded at various times by a group of remoras that includes Steve Bannon, Michael Anton, Peter Navarro, Wilbur Ross, Larry Kudlow, and Stephen Miller, all of whom seem perfectly delighted to expand government power as long as they're using it to carry out their nationalist populist agenda. In his first State of the Union speech, Trump called for a massive infrastructure bill, an affordable child care plan, trade restrictions, a border wall, and allowing governors flexibility to expand Medicare. If the last sounds familiar, it's what Obamacare did most effectively. Give states enormous tranches of money to spend like drunken sailors on shore leave. Compassionate conservatives sought to turn the power of government to accomplish conservative ends while shrinking its numerous deleterious side effects. The thought that we could use government to aid the truly needy while moving people toward laudable goals like improved education outcomes, home ownership, and community service may not have been libertarian perfection, but it was at least a middle ground in the political space in which we really live. Not Randian, not Fabian. The troll party of Trump has no hesitation using the power of government to bring their fantasy economic and social policies to life. Trump has done more to destroy limited government conservatism than George Soros could have accomplished in 1,000 years. This is where Trump's rhetorical hypnosis went to work. The message was no longer, conservatives like me will restrain the power and scale of government. Now the message was, I'm going to expand government to fuck over the people you hate. This was the underlying Bannon, Anton, Miller axis of assholes nationalism in its true form. We're going to put the all-powerful state to work punishing those who have caused your grievances. For all their objections to the administrative state, it turns out that Trump's merry band of arsonists are perfectly happy to use the power of government to punish their enemies and appease their base. If government is, as Ronald Reagan put it, the enemy of liberty, then Trump's base has turned that idea on its head. Now, the government is the enemy of whoever the base hates most. Reagan also spoke to generations of Republicans and conservatives when he said in 1986, "The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, 'I'm from the government and I'm here to help.'" For the Trump team, the new message is, "I'm from the government and I'm here to punish the people you hate." We hate big government, except when it's getting the Mexicans. In the 2008 presidential election, Barack Obama said in a July 2nd speech something that set Republicans howling in paranoia and fury. "We cannot rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded." The quote was, of course, taken wildly out of context, but it didn't stop talk radio hosts from losing their damn minds over it for days. And it didn't take long for Republican members of Congress to follow suit. Representative Paul Brown, a Republican from Georgia, spoke for many on the conservative side when he said, "That's exactly what Hitler did in Nazi Germany, and it's exactly what the Soviet Union did. When he's proposing to have a national security force that's answering to him that is as strong as the U.S. military, he's showing signs to me of being a Marxist." Contrast this with the Republican cheering of Trump's national deportation force. A favorite trope of the 2016 campaign, Trump declared war on immigrants from his first speech as a candidate, and his promises to deport 11 to 14 million illegal immigrants was a singular hit with his base. As opposed to Obama's imagined and never implemented civilian national security force, Trump's team moved quickly to deliver on his promise to put the power of the state to work to make America less Hispanic. Trump immediately signed Executive Order 13767 to kick off the immigration and deportation crackdown he repeatedly and tiresomely promised his base. Almost immediately, the party of small government was pushing to vastly expand the size of the Customs and Border Patrol, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the Department of Homeland Security. It was also all in on expanding private prison contracts to house those arrested in the deportation effort, and bellowed about how soon Trump would build his border wall. These not-so-subtle efforts were a signal to his alt-right base and less savory supporters that he was going to prevent the one future that makes Mark Krikorian, Mickey Kaus, and Ann Coulter wake up in a cold sweat, the infamous Browning of America. By the spring of 2018, however, Trump's promises to build the wall had flopped like a branded Trump Tower in some third-world kleptocracy. Time and again he'd tweet about the wall, only to blow it when Congress presented spending bills in which a smarter, more canny president might have made a deal and delivered on his signature promise in the first year. Sad. Trump had to do something to relieve the pressure. For a hot minute, he tried to fund the wall through the Department of Defense budget, only to be schooled on the appropriations process. He then ordered 4,000 National Guard troops to the border. This move was a lot less than it seemed. Presidents Bush and Obama both deployed U.S. forces to support ICE and Customs. His followers, though, including the odious Ann Coulter, hoped that American troops would soon be shooting Mexican migrants as they crossed into the United States. On the Lars Larson radio program, Coulter said, "If you shoot one to encourage the others, maybe they'll learn." Fiscal conservatism goes belly up. Trump's budgets and spending plans are, as you might imagine, reflective of a man who has lived on credit his entire life, never balanced the books, and never cared if his debts were paid. The party that screamed its lungs out that Barack Obama was bankrupting America during his 8-year term is suddenly just fine on record debts, deficit spending, easy money flooding Wall Street from the Fed, and every other form of economic heresy of the erstwhile Republican philosophy of fiscal probity. Trump's proposals of a trillion here and a trillion there in new federal spending are reflective not only of his own lifetime addiction to greater fool theory credit, but also to an utter lack of even a passing regard for fiscal sanity. Trump's first budgets were wonders of rosy scenarios, mathematical legerdemain that opens up entirely new fields of number theory, phantom budget cuts, and mythical savings from that old favorite, ending fraud, waste, and abuse. His first budget was received even by many of Trump's fans in Congress with the same delight as one might experience in finding a turd in a punch bowl. Even the Heritage Foundation's Stephen Moore, a Trump supporter and sometime advisor, was displeased. "It's a big spending budget," he said, "and it's not what, you know, conservatives want to see. Whether Republicans are hypocritical, I mean, I think right now you could say they are because they certainly criticized Obama for running up big deficits, which he did. But now we're seeing that happen under a Republican administration. This is a very unusual Republican budget." And about that whole smaller government promise, not so much. The Trump budget projects a 55% rise in federal spending between 2017 and 2028. For those of you playing our home game, 55% is rather a goddamn lot. Trump gave the GOP what it obviously had always wanted. Instead of the fiscal discipline we pledged and campaigned on for generations, and that is objectively necessary for the nation's long-term fiscal health, we adopted the economics of Donald Trump's life. Borrow, spend, crash, go bankrupt. Find greater fool lenders for the next round of borrowing, spending, crashing, and bankruptcy. Our reputation for fiscal conservatism has always had a whiff of bullshit about it, even in eras where we had control of the House, Senate, and White House. We talked a big game on entitlement reform, lowering the burdens on middle-class taxpayers and ending the kind of government lard voters roundly pretend to hate until it gets spent in their districts or states. In the age of Trump, we largely stopped pretending. I've made hundreds of ads for candidates and written as many speeches in which they promise on the lives of their children that they're going to be the one who finally gets to Washington and cuts the wasteful spending at the Department of Wasteful Spending. They're going to be the one who finally gets control of government spending, cuts regulations, and bitch slaps that deficit so hard it never shows its face in this town again. Yeah, at least Trump let my party stop pretending. Eat, spend, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die broke. Oh, there are still a few tattered, dodgy fig leaves covering our fiscal junk. With the passage of the tax bill, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell created a new, extra special budget committee to finally, really, pinky swear for real, get America's fiscal house in order. Wink emoji. Love ya. Mean it. Budget expert and economist Stan Collender nailed it when he said, "This new select committee on the budget isn't just utter nonsense. It's an insult to our intelligence. We're being told not to look at the big deficit hikes that were just enacted, but to pay attention instead to yet another attempt to prevent it from happening again." Infrastructure. Ah, infrastructure. The policy unicorn that everyone loves in theory, that Congress and lobbyists dine out on for their constituents and clients, and that always flops on execution. In the Trump era, Republicans threw aside their objections to massive, top-down federal stimulus programs. And let's face it, that's all infrastructure plans are, really. Everyone loves cutting the ribbons and having a bridge named after them. But most of these programs fall far short of their promised economic benefits. Or at least that's what conservatives used to believe. Trump's $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan was a back-of-the-envelope political creation of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, trade warrior Peter Navarro, and Steve Bannon. Their interests were a combination of oligarchic self-interest, economic nationalism, and raw populism, and the plan reflected just that. The Kellyanne version of it went like this. We're going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, and hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we'll put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it. A few conservative economists, such as the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Mark Scribner, expressed their skepticism over the plan. Scribner wrote, "Contrary to the dominant political narrative from members of both parties, which is parroted uncritically by most of the press, there's little evidence that these public works projects promote long-run economic growth." Trump's $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan included $200 billion in federal spending and a whole lot of, quote, public-private partnership magical thinking, and never got much further than being mocked each time it was brought up as the theme of the week. More boom boom for Supreme Generalissimo Trump. Here's an irony. I spent a part of my early career trying to save the defense budget when I worked in Dick Cheney's Pentagon at the end of the Cold War. We were going to have a peace dividend if it killed us. In terms of our defense budget, it almost did. In the years that followed, I helped corporate defense contractor clients fight for DoD contracts to build a variety of things that either spy on the bad guys or leave a smoking crater where the bad guys were just before we decided their bunker, desert tent, drug lab, or condo needed to go boom. While it's not all for North Korean-style missile parades, Trump's defense spending plans aren't tethered to a revised international defense strategy, but rather to a mere bigger-is-better preference. Trump's record-breaking defense spending plan hit the $716 billion mark in 2018, leaving even Mick Mulvaney, Trump's relentlessly upbeat budget chief, shaking his head. In the anodyne language of the Washington Post, it was, quote, a major increase that signals a shift away from concerns about the rising deficit and was a setback for deficit hawks. By setback, they mean, sweet Jesus, that's a lot of money. At least it's for Mattis. Family leave. Another of Trump's proposals that dragged conservatives down a path of policy apostasy came in the form of Ivanka Trump's family leave proposals. Giving parents paid leave so they can care for newborn kids is a puppies and kittens plan. Who wouldn't love that? In 1993, Congress passed and Bill Clinton signed the Family and Medical Leave Act, which provides up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for family medical needs or childbirth. The catch, of course, is the whole unpaid part. Long a tentpole argument of the Democrats, paid family leave is a standard everywhere else in the world. Republicans had forever rolled their eyes over this with an ironic sigh and said, yes, we get it. Norway is awesome. How are you going to pay for it? The idea had its Republican adherents, including my friend Marco Rubio. You can see why it's broadly popular, at least until the topic of, you know, paying for the damn thing comes front and center. Republicans struggled for ages on how to provide leave without breaking the bank. Looking for a way to get suburban mommies to think the GOP isn't a party of rotund, ass-slapping old white dudes? Well, hello, ladies. Meet the Ivanka Trump family leave plan. Sounds great, right? The devil in the details was the price tag. The plan championed by Ivanka Trump used, wait for it, Social Security to pay for it. Already reeling from an unsustainable financial model and staggering under costs driven by a steep growth curve on its disability benefits, Social Security wasn't a logical pool of money for this proposal, which almost any rational political figure could have suggested to Team Trump on day one. The Democrats' proposal for paid family leave has long been centered on a new federal payroll tax, which in a moment of stark political irony makes their position more conservative than the Trump plan. Yes, they want a gazillion-dollar new nanny state entitlement, but at least they weren't engaged in magical thinking on how to get there. Entitlement reform and the GOP are never, never, never getting back together. When it comes to reforming Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, Trump knows his audience. He's not touching the three entitlement programs that drive the vast bulk of federal spending. Those folks rely on federal largesse, despite their avowed desire to get government on a fiscal diet, despite the acknowledged coming insolvency.